Right.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of the very soggy Los Angeles, California, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpak Hollywood Hour, and I'm Dean Haglund. And I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes.
I'm having such a sense of deja vu.
I know.
And yet, when I feel like you just did that opening 45 seconds to a minute ago, I've got to tell you, it was nowhere near as exciting.
What?
That just now
was way more exciting?
It was flawless.
Because I'm totally pissed off that we had to do it again. We never do these shows twice.
I know, we never do. No, we don't edit.
We don't rehearse. There's nothing. This is an exciting time, though.
That's, you know what, that's really interesting, because off air, we were just talking about the fact that I've been cutting together a special little bonus
show.
Episode.
That sounds fun.
Chilpak Hollywood Hour, that we'll talk about more in the weeks to come, yeah. But it really is interesting to be editing something involving Chilpak Hollywood Hour, because rarely is there any editing. We edited for our third anniversary show last year, edited together
panel interviews
from London.
Yeah, that's right.
With Robin Tudge, author of co-author of Rough Guides to Conspiracy, and a new book that I'm going to be getting when we're in London about global surveillance.
Ooh.
And also, of course, historian and author and journalist Graham Hancock.
Yeah.
So we had panel interviews with them, and then you and I got a little bit tipsy at a pub.
That doesn't sound
shortly like... after concluding photography, for the truth is out there, we immediately retired to the nearest bar, to the nearest pub, and over many, many pints,
we
swapped jokes, and also somehow you got me to come completely clean about some behind-the-scenes dirt on the making of my very first film, and I'd never, ever... revealed some of those things.
Wow, anyway, I should listen to that show because I don't remember that.
So that's the... well, you remember things in like states. So yeah. Start drinking, and by the end of the show, you'll remember exactly what I
said. Let's crack
you.
One. Okay. What a show we have.
Yeah. I am gratified that it seems like all the momentum that we had perhaps not really lost, but felt like we'd lost
yes.
when our whole... Chilpak Hollywood Hour site, chilpakhollywood.com.
Collapsed under the weight of its own.
No, when it got wiped clean by someone who went in and wiped it clean.
Oh, yeah, right.
To mention names, Farpoint Media would be so indiscreet.
So indiscreet.
And yet, you know, we people have found us again. People are listening to the shows. They
We're
seem
back.
To really have enjoyed these last couple shows.
We're here.
A great deal.
Exactly.
And how much fun was it last week having Chris Jacobs from Entertainment Tonight up on the roof?
Up on a roof. And me with my tan, my killer tan.
Which really can be enjoyed in an audio only podcast.
Trust me, I'm not kidding.
So people seem to like the newly redesigned Chilpak Hollywood.
Thank you very much. Redesigned that myself.
Chilpak Hollywood.com. Mm-hmm. You can now find, I think, almost. I don't know. I was told there'd be no math. But after today, I think you can find more than 15 of our shows. This
more
is
that, yeah.
Chilpak Hollywood Hour 201.
Wow.
Today.
Space Odyssey.
And you can find more than 15 of our past shows. Gradually, over the coming months and years, we will add all the back catalog of shows.
That'll be fun.
And now, through our official site, you can also subscribe from iTunes. You
yes.
can go to our site. And there is a link there that will take you to the show's
subscribe
page on iTunes, and you can subscribe.
Look at how easy that is.
So we're back fully in the swing of things. Of course, we really, more than ever, I think, need to thank our friends at Jackalope Radio.
They were right there for us during their downtime.
Stream the show a couple times a week and also make downloads of it available in their archives.
Very sweet
and, of them. And you know, it was so touching, and I know, of course, they had things writing on it, so they had to get in touch with us, but how great was it to hear from the day we're having all these problems from our friends at The Cockroach at thetalksuperstation.com,
yeah.
which also streams our show every week. You know, hearing from them right away Is there a problem? How can we get the show? What can we, you know, what can we do? Because it was that kind of communication we never got from our distribution network.
We had no idea if anybody was listening.
We had no idea if anybody was listening. We had no idea if anybody was helping. We had no idea if anybody cared. I was beginning to doubt that you even existed, even when I was sitting next to you.
I doubt I exist.
And so it's fantastic that not only these people want to bring our shows to their listeners, but they're communicative with us, and they engage with us and interact with us. And that's great, because what we just care about the most is that this show, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, reaches as many people as possible and as many people join us in this ongoing conversation.
Absolutely. And we sell ad space. Oh, no, wait, how did that get there?
Before we, this is, you know, I usually like structuring a nice conversation for a show, going from topic to topic.
Yeah. And,
but there was something that
stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, I there's nowhere that this fits in, but I knew I had to share it because I knew that this was this involves several things that alternately tickle you and anger you to no end. This combines several of your favorite hot button issues.
Oh no!
Someone,
Mylar balloons. Here we go.
Someone, I'm not going to say who, forwarded to me really top secret, private information.
Awesome.
Documents, actually.
I didn't get
that
them.
Are really. I mean, you need to sign away your life that these will never go outside your.
I love that stuff.
So, of course, I'm talking about sides and instructions for an audition. This is so much more secretive than, in some cases, than the government information.
Remember when they would come on red pages so you couldn't photocopy it?
Couldn't photocopy it.
Yeah, that was funny.
But there are disclaimers all over this thing.
Uh-huh.
But one of the disclaimers was for the agents, for the casting director, for the actors themselves. And it's for a McDonald's commercial.
No way.
I love that in all caps, it's instructed that the performers auditioning must be. It's always fun that they use a negative incorrectly, but they must be, all caps, not overweight.
You're kidding.
No, in the breakdown.
Must not be overweight.
No, must be not overweight.
So must be underweight. What? How?
Just so interesting.
Wow.
But then here's the great. And then they wrote C boards because, of course, they drew what the people should look like.
The actual weight size they're looking for.
It reminds me of what Margaret Cho said that she went through when she had her sitcom or short-lived sitcom. Yeah. And she almost killed herself, starving herself and
trying
everything.
To get thin.
Because she would go into the boardroom, right? And they would pull down a chart of her body and indicate, we need you to lose weight here, 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 and here. You need to look more like you do in the storyboards, basically. As opposed to making the storyboards look like.
Because
the marketing department had drawn up the storyboard.
Yeah, and that's how they cast.
And that's exactly what happens with a commercial.
Yeah,
right.
You actually look for people who look like the storyboards.
But this is the language that you're going to love, and I am just directly quoting. Okay, this is the disclaimer. Any actor hired for a McDonald's commercial must be prepared to eat McDonald's products during his/her performance. Please avoid casting actors with an aversion to eating meat and or other similar products.
Oh, my God. Well,
let's begin with the ending there. The meat and or other similar products.
Which is what we sell.
Yeah, we're not saying we're selling meat. No. We're selling meat similar products.
Meat simulacrums. Exactly. Simulacrums. Delicious. Yeah, you know, this is a problem because a friend of mine did a burger commercial and he wouldn't eat the damn thing and nobody on the set would. So they all had to fake, the production assistant had to eat the burger into teeth marks and then they put their lips and looked like they were chewing. And that was a major problem when you do 6 or 7 takes and you eat this garbage. And the other thing is the burgers aren't hot. Those are cold and then they will draw in felt marker charbroil marks on the meat and then shoot a little steam gun on it just before the take to make it look like it's a hot steamy burger because otherwise it's too hard to control the look of that burger. There's food stylists on set that work specifically with cold food to make it look like it's hot and steamy. Using hair dryers to melt the cheese, felt markers to do char marks, little steam guns to make it look like it's hot off the grill.
Isn't that
gross? So, and then you're supposed to eat that? Go to hell. They can have that commercial themselves. I'm not doing it.
I thought you would get a little kick.
I'm not doing it.
I love that, though, you know, they are willing to be so specific about, like, they're not even allowed in their language in a casting breakdown to claim that it is always meat.
So, yeah. So the person, the actor, has to eat the damn thing probably 6 or 7 times per take, and then they have to be not overweight. Where are you going to find that person? Well, there's one actor in all of town that's probably doing that.
Yeah.
And that person's bulimic.
Is bulimic.
Exactly.
Well, so there's many more than one person, actually. There you go. Quite frankly, they came to the right town for that.
Gazinga.
Exciting day here at the offices of Rational Exuberance.
Feel the excitement.
The first two reviews of our movie, The Truth Is Out There.
Came out?
Came out. One at comedyfilmnerds.com and the other at glasgowtothemovies.com, Josh Glasgow's website.
Right.
I'm going to let you dive in. I was kind of surprised that you'd read the reviews, although now I'm beginning to realize you didn't entirely read the reviews.
I just read
it. I wasn't sure if you would, because I would think it would be harder for you to read it.
Yes, it is harder for me to read it, as is it's hard to watch the movie, because it is very personal, and I come across as an ass. So, anyway, no, I don't do it.
You don't? No, but here's a file. Now, see, you're needy again. This is the thing. No, this is exactly why I wasn't sure if you would. I didn't ask you to read them. I didn't tell you to read them. I just thought we would have this discussion here.
Well,
but what I have witnessed, of course, is it is hard. It's hard for any actor, not any actor, but it's hard for many actors to watch their performances. Mm-hmm. Then, and I can relate to this more, when you're then watching quote-unquote yourself, as opposed to the character that you're playing, I think that presents a slightly different challenge for an actor to watch, but potentially an even more disturbing challenge.
Yeah, and particularly in theater, which is my background, of course, and we were told specifically by our theater teachers, do not read your reviews during the run, because A, if it's a great review, you'll become self-conscious, particularly if they quote a line or a particular scene that you do, that scene will forever be ruined, because there will always be something in the back of your head thinking about that review as you do the scene. Nobody's that mentally tough that they can block out something they read. Good, being it a great review, will screw you up just as much as somebody goes, this guy was the worst piece of crap. Like I did a play, a Samuel Beckett play, and it said Beckett was spelt wrong twice in the program, but that was least of the damage done.
Right.
And that was like, how bad a review can that be?
Well, and so then you think, how hard can it be? I mean, your function, at least one of your functions in the film The Truth Is Out There, is almost to serve as host.
Right.
And so then someone might say, well, how hard can it be to read your reviews as host? But I guarantee you, the Jon Stewarts of the world, the David Lettermans, the really great hosts, aren't reading their reviews, and probably, if they did, have a really hard time reading them, and probably just hate watching themselves. I mean, I think that's one of the things that you can tell about them is that they wouldn't take great pleasure in watching what they do.
No, because you're also listening, so you're engaged in almost a mental game as opposed to something that you want to watch afterwards.
It's like watching
a chess,
or you're being in the moment, or whatever. It is all encompassing. Maybe it's like an athlete where you are in that moment with your entire instrument, but then to watch it forces you into a specifically mental space. Yeah,
absolutely.
And
mentally, I've been meaning to put the last 5 years of my live convention improv shows up on YouTube, but I'd have to watch them.
That's the thing.
They sit there.
So for you, it's always been a challenge to watch this film, while at the same time, you're an executive producer on the film, and it's your company, and so you have a vested interest in this film that goes beyond being... or
personal.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least is complementary to your interest in it as a performer.
Right.
And so, at some point, you needed to move beyond that with a critical eye. And then also, you know, the experience of seeing it with an audience and really realizing, oh, okay, I see what this film is about
right
now.
They're where it connects.
And but then the danger of then reading reviews that the reviews pose is it puts you right back into the personal again.
True.
And that's the challenge with it. You know, you have to move beyond the personal into the transpersonal in life as well as in
wow.
art.
Wow. We all have to move into the transpersonal.
And then reviews can threaten to put you back into the personal.
Yeah.
And that can be okay if then you take what you've learned from it and make it, again, transpersonal, if it furthers the conversation. Because, you know, this, you know, I did a fairly comprehensive interview with Josh Glasgow week prior to the review that he wrote. And, you know, one of the questions was, and I was a little uncomfortable with answering all of it.
Right.
But it was the question of what do I think the role of critics are. And we've talked about this a great deal on the show.
Yeah.
And that's also one of the reasons why, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with trying to
define it.
To narrow down, you know, to parse out an ongoing and ever-deepening discussion we're having about the role of critics, be they film critics, cultural critics, art critics, whatever, but the role of critics and criticism, which is such an important conversation, and trying to parse that down and boil that down into a concise couple paragraphs is to, I think, in a degree, undermine how important the function of critics are, the subject of criticism is, mm-hmm. much in the same way, you know, reviewing a movie in two paragraphs is to reduce its importance
down too.
But I answered with what was, you know, on my mind, foremost in my thoughts at that point. But one of the things that I didn't mention is that this is all about, you know, hopefully, you know, helping to build the world in which we want to live. We're doing that as artists. Hopefully critics are doing that through their criticism.
Right.
It's all to contribute to the ongoing conversation, to inspire, you know. Only recently have critics, quote-unquote critics, become simply reviewers.
Right.
Like, this is good, this is bad, aren't I clever?
Right. As the way it was before.
You know, as opposed to actually being criticism, as opposed to being analysis, as opposed to being something that might encourage the artists to approach things in a different way or to... Or at least to embrace other possibilities, but at the same time to inspire an audience to look at things in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah,
to enrich the overall experience.
With the triangle of the viewer, maker, and
the critic.
And the critic.
That this should be an ongoing dialogue between the three of them.
Right.
And ironically, as we've talked about before, with the greater access that we have to each other and all these great communication tools at our disposal, you look around, and there's plenty of evidence to see that communication itself has broken down.
Isn't that
despite
ironic?
All our communication tools.
How ironic. And this also then dates back. I mean, you go back through history and seeing where critics have got it wrong. Like, you Waiting for Godot, all critics hated that. And then it was all the French critics actually banded together and wrote Samuel Beckett an apology, bringing back Samuel Beckett, because they realized that they had so missed the point on that play and that the audience responded to it so strongly. It was a hit show that ran.
Well, let's talk about film again. We mentioned this just a couple weeks ago. In 1982, Blade Runner comes out.
Right.
Not only is it a financial flop, but it took the Ladd Company under with it. And largely it was a financial flop because critics laid in wait and decimated it.
Right.
It got dreadful reviews.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about those reviews is that the best reviewers out there, the ones who were truly reviewers to, in a way, grow old with, because they were not only insightful people who brought integrity to what they did, but were also pleasing writers. I mean, it was fun to read the way that these critics used language. And boy, how much has that been lost
yes.
in the era of the blurb and the soundbite and this.
And the tweet.
The use of language and the elevation of language. I mean, more than anything else, I would say that a critic is a writer.
Right.
And
they write about...
And so being a good writer is fundamentally important in being a good critic.
Yes.
And so anyway... Blade Runner, panned by critics. Less than 11 years later, it's on the Congressional Registry of, you know, films that have to be protected. And when you read the reviews, by the good reviewers, by the insightful reviewers, by the reviewers with integrity, there was a similar tone through all of it, which was the large criticism they laid at the feet of the film was actually the point of the film. And once they understood that, once they pulled out enough, because that's the danger that critics, that's the trap for critics, is that you move so far into a piece to dissect it, to analyze it, to that sometimes you miss the elephant in the room. Mm. That critic, in trying to be all the blind men, right, taking all the things, no, it's a rope, no, it's a tree trunk, yeah, no, it's this. You know what? If you just took five steps back, you wouldn't need to be grabbing a hold of all these things. You'd see it. And they missed the point with Blade Runner. And then years go by. Oh, right. Right. Of course the replicants are more human than human. Right. The movie kept hitting us over the head with it. That's the point.
I didn't see that.
Okay. Well, 14 years before that, 2001 A Space Odyssey comes out. Do you ever see a top 10 films of all time list without 2001 A Space Odyssey being on it? No. Landmark film that got bad reviews. Hmm. Critics did not make that film.
Right.
The young college audiences made that film. Yeah. Critics caught up to it later.
Interesting.
As they tended to do with a lot of Kubrick stuff, because something about Kubrick left them cold. And that wasn't a weakness with it. That was the point.
Right.
Because, you know, when I was asked by Josh Glasgow in that interview about my favorite filmmakers, it was really interesting to me how much humanity there was in all of these directors. And yet what was interesting was a guy like Kubrick, you know, you would think just from his films, oh my, what a cold intellectual man he must be. But you find out what films he loved, and nothing could have been further from it. In fact, he used the dehumanization of man, the coldness, the sterility, the machine-like nature of what man was evolving into in his films,
yeah,
to warn us against that very thing.
Right, these things were warnings, yeah.
Yeah.
But often
that will get missed.
Yeah.
And so, but your point with Beckett is, you know, is well made, and this will always be the case. There will always be these. But I would argue that the film, that the critics didn't fail in their jobs by writing those reviews that missed the point. They didn't.
They did not.
In fact, would Blade Runner have had the afterlife that it did? Would 2001 have had the afterlife it did if it weren't for those negative reviews initially?
Hmm.
If it wasn't for the people who got it championing it so
much,
powerfully,
yeah,
and then through their passion, through their engagement with others, starting to turn the tide. I mean, look at Star Trek. So the legacy of Star Trek was largely cemented, if you think about it, by its failure.
Right.
In 1969.
When it was canceled after three seasons, that's when the popularity began.
Right.
Isn't that funny? So, but then this is also, you hear these arguments to justify bad reviews when they go, oh, well, critics have never got, you know, here I joined this list. And yet we got positive reviews, and yet we're still citing these references.
Well, let's talk about this then a little bit. So what, you know, again, you can find these reviews, and we've linked them at our Facebook page for the film.
The truth is out there.
No, the Facebook page for the film is facebook.com/truthmovie. If you want to be a liker of the film, and if you do become a liker of the film, you know, we'll notify you about screenings in the area.
Right.
Of course, you can also join our mailing list on truth-is-out-there.com. And you can write Dean and I anytime you want at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Anyway, the first review was Neil Weekly's review on comedyfilmnerds.com.
Yeah.
And I thought it was almost kind of the perfect review.
Yeah, kind of. He reviewed, I mean, he summarized a lot of it.
Without giving anything away.
Right. Did a good job there. called me Smarty Pants.
Well, you really do take things personally.
No, I was honored by that.
Well, I thought, you know, it's tough to talk about these two reviews without comparing and contrasting them because we have two
right
in front of us. And so it can't be this or that. It's got to be this and that. But I found it very interesting that you read the review in Comedy Film Nerds, and the film is very much about you.
So
not the review. The film is about you.
Right.
You read the review in Glasgow to the Movies, and it really isn't very much about you.
Yeah.
There's a, you know, it's as if that was just in there. Literally half that movie is all about you. Has nothing to do with conspiracy theories or these, except insofar as what all these things reflect about you. Right. What these things, therefore, reflect about us. Because you are our into that world. We see the world through your eyes. But we also see the inward journey through your eyes. But it's very interesting that for some people it will be about Dean Haglund. For others, wasn't that much about Dean Haglund. It's only peripherally about Dean Haglund.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's really...
Well, and that's been the nature of even what we found at the test screening, that every person that came up to us had a different experience watching this thing.
Well, you know, we've known... I've got to tell you, this was not a fun movie for me to make. And one of the reasons it was not
and
fun,
me.
Maybe the primary reason it was not fun, is that there was no getting it right.
Yeah.
There was no, and I've thought about this a lot, and there was no way for me to ever get it right. That getting it right didn't even exist
right
in this. In fact, this film was counter to that. It argues against the modality of getting something right.
Right.
It and you know, and that's...
That there is no right or wrong in the duality of quantum thinking.
Well, that's why this relationship between this film and critics is so fascinating.
Right.
Because their job, more or less, is to say, okay, the filmmaker achieved their aims, or this audience will find this pleasing, this audience might not, or I enjoy... You know, but it's... But they're really... That's what's fascinating, is that it's almost taking one set of conversational tools... And applying
it
to a different language altogether.
Right, that doesn't apply.
And I am right there with them. I'm right there with critics who have that challenge, because in editing, we've talked before, it's very easy to say the film is too long. I feel the film is too long. You probably feel the film is too long. Lyle probably feels the film is too long. You know, and at the same time, I also know that the film is exactly the length that it has to be.
Right.
That it isn't this or that. It's both of these things. That, no two people at all have come up to us. Many people have come up to us. Maybe yes. Half the people who've seen it have said, there's things you could cut out.
Right.
Right? But then once you start to press them on, well, what could you cut out? It becomes absolutely personal to them.
Right, that there's no one scene that everybody points to that goes.
Reviewer Josh Glasgow, God bless him, made very specific offers of what we could have cut out.
Right.
He was the first person ever to suggest the things could be cut out that he suggested.
Right.
Everyone Nobody else had ever done it. And like one of the things was about your nephew talking about his adventures in ayahuasca.
Yeah.
Right? That this didn't have any direct relation.
Yet it reverberates.
In fact, it kept coming up again and again. And when
all through it.
And when something you don't know about at all keeps coming up with disparate people around the world bringing it up again and again, you got to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And so we had to. We had to honor. This was being given to us to honor it, right? And this sounds like I'm defending including it, but really what's interesting to me is that what that journey of a close relative of yours mirrored about you and about how
this
the truth
journey.
Lies on the inward journey. Well, that's fascinating that was
seen as something that could
or
be
was
cut,
lost or was lost. Was lost in the translation to this particular individual, whereas others dig it. And that's fascinating. And it's frustrating. And that's what made editing it not fun, what makes it viewing now delicious to me. But again, boy, in the editing room, you know, you go, I know this is too long. I know this is too long. But if I cut this out, we're going to lose these people because this matters to some people.
Right. Or we lose this breathing space, and then that second thing that comes after it comes too close on the heels of this, and we lose the whole function of that.
So isn't this interesting that mm-hmm. what you end up with is a film that to be allowed to work, because that's really the question, is the film going to work? And for the film to be allowed to work, I got to the very frustrating, very disturbing, very ulcer-inducing, migraine-inducing, tantrum-inducing place where to make a film that worked meant you had to include the flaws.
That's me in a nutshell.
And isn't it also the world?
Yep.
That the beauty of it has to include the flaws of it.
Right. You can't remove that, or you don't have the
beauty. You don't have all of it.
You don't have all of
you
it.
You don't have all of it. You don't have all the colors. You don't have all the tastes, all the senses, all the smells. You don't have the full, rich tapestry and banquet of it all. And this is where I want to get with these two interviews. What I thought was, these reviews, again, a contrast between them. I thought it was great that Neil Weakley, who didn't seem to have really a dog in the hunt with any of these particular theories,
right.
His response to when the film got really dense, and you know this was always my concern, like when it gets dense, are people going to shut off to this?
Right.
And I found it very much like we did in San Leandro at the X-Fest, UFO X-Fest, but I found it really rewarding that a man sitting alone watching the DVD of it had the same experience that that audience did, which is when it got particularly dense, the reaction was not to cut off from it or check out. The response was to lean forward and listen more closely.
Right.
That somehow we did our job enough where we encouraged people
as a way in
to come closer. Yeah. To come closer. This might be really difficult, but come closer and there will be rewards.
Right.
Don't sit back. Don't check out and think, oh, this is going to be too hard.
Right.
And hopefully that's the kind of thing that will continue to reward people as they rewatch it and generations to come, maybe as they find this film, because who knows?
Who knows what kind of legs this thing has?
And then in contrast to that, what I thought was very interesting was Josh. And I agreed to do that interview with Josh Glasgow.
The 20 questions?
Yeah. Because I got to tell you, this Josh listens to the show. He's a reviewer, listens to this show. And, I had read his stuff before, because I like checking out what our audience and what our friends, what they do, Yeah. And it's always very, as I've said, it's very humbling and inspiring to know all the amazing things that the people in our audience are up to. And so you find out, wow, this film critic is, a young guy. And his writing is superb.
Yeah.
He is he's a gifted writer. He language is his ally. Exactly what I was kind of saying earlier about critics needing to be great writers. He is so ahead of the game because he is a great writer, and he is very thoughtful and brings an incredible amount of integrity to it. And he is absent that sense of trying to prove anything about himself.
Right.
Which is so wonderful because it invites everyone in. And really, I had the experience while I was reading, not in spite of his criticisms of the film, but because of his criticisms of the film, I was going, okay, this man is a critic to grow old with. This is a guy I read. Whereas I loved the review in Comedy Film Nerds, but it didn't necessarily inspire in me repeat reading of future reviews by that reviewer. Whereas if he reviewed a film that I was curious about, then I would read it.
Right.
But there are still reviewers that I want to read, regardless of whether I necessarily had an interest in the film,
right,
per se. And Josh is one of these reviewers. Hmm. And anyway, I loved that he went at a piece in the film, and specifically, and it's at the midpoint in the movie, and it's when our friend, artist, and philosopher Lee McCloskey shows to you that wonderful painting that he has that is painted on the back of all the books in the religion section of his library.
Yeah.
That wonderful painting. And it shows, as he pulls out one of those books to you and shows that the spine of it, of all those books, are painted, and that each book has its own unique beauty, but that if you remove one from that painting, the work is not complete.
Right.
And the message of that work, of course, is that You know, it's about all times, all traditions, all thoughts, all points of view. Everything has its own unique beauty to offer. And if we can stop arguing over who's right and who's wrong, we can take a step back and look, oh, it is all these things that together make this beautiful tapestry.
Right.
And Josh used the words describing this, that point of view is truly insane.
I know. I was taken aback.
And this was fascinating. Absolutely. Yeah. I was taken aback by it. And you know, and loved that he wrote that.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing. Here's where criticism is actually contributing to the conversation, because this is what the movie's about.
Yeah, totally.
This is what it's about. He, at the halfway point, is not only foreshadowing, but exactly saying what our scientists at the end. You've got a painter saying exactly what our scientists and physicists are going to say at the end of the film.
Right.
About the quantum nature of consciousness, about us being at this evolutionary stage in our development where we can start to embrace the truly quantum nature, not the bifurcated, the dual nature,
yes,
in which we've been living.
Binary.
But this spherical nature.
Right.
It's a sphere, and the ability that we have to embrace all possibilities, as you like to talk about with Schrodinger's cat.
Schrodinger's cat, alive and dead at the same time in a box.
And he's right. It is a form of insanity. And for most of us, it represents the worst form of insanity, that we need to believe in specific things. We need to know, no, that is factual, that is not factual.
Right.
Not all things are equally valid, right?
Yeah, that's how we technically define our way through the universe.
It's one of the ways that we protect ourselves, because without it, there's chaos.
Right, theoretically, as Edgar Allan Poe wrote in The Fall of House Usher. Right?
Of course, you get to a point where if you can remain grounded enough in the nourishing truths that make us human, the true knowings, the true things of which you can have knowledge. I love my friends. I love my family. Right. I love my life. These are the things that make this life worth living. If you can ground yourself in the true knowing of those things, as you flower upwards from those knowings, you can indeed embrace all possibilities. And as Marilyn Schlitz, the anthropologist and scientist who runs the Institute of Noetic Sciences, explains, it's exactly that ability, that insanity, that will save us in the 21st century. It is only the skill set that comes from that can save us as around us things are collapsing like dominoes.
Wow.
Because if you cling to any one truism,
and that collapses.
Yeah, or multiple truisms and those collapse, then you do not have the ability to move forward going, oh, good. Look what happened.
Right.
What can we make of this?
Yeah, technically the rug is pulled out from under you and you lose your pinnings to a reality.
And so, of course, though, if you come from the standpoint that it is insane to think that all things have equal validity, then, of course, there are things that can be cut out.
Right.
Right? The danger in this is that...
Then you make a judgment.
You make a judgment that's always based on your point of view. This is what can be cut out. And, you know, I loved David Aronofsky's book about, the conspiracy theories. No, not Darren Aronofsky, the author, David Aronovich. About voodoo histories.
And
I liked it. But this is one of the problems that I had with him, you know, is that, you know, his approach that, no, all points of view are not valid. Some are more factual. Some lead to the truth more. Some lead to this. But he's missing the point that there is a larger sense of validity, which is that each and every individual has as much validity as any other individual.
Right.
And your right to express what you uniquely as an individual hold to be true and relevant and valuable is no more valid than my ability to express it. What I may offer may be more or less resonant, more or less practical, more or less pleasing, whatever it is, than what you have to offer at any given moment. But only when everyone's validity is truly recognized will we then be able to truly build from the ideas that are the best among us, given the circumstances in which we find ourselves. But of course, too much of the judgment of ideas, maybe all of the judgment of ideas, ends with the judgment of the individual expressing them these days.
Which becomes the problem with our Congress and our whole political system.
Well, with everything.
Well,
and,
yes.
And in this world but of conspiracy, where, you know, I looked around and I saw so many people who have so much in common, i.e. all of us who are not in charge, fighting with each other.
Yeah.
Over who did what to whom and why they're doing it and all this sort of stuff. You know, it's like the conversation you and I have had sometimes before, that maybe the true conspiracy is the conspiracy theories, because it really seems like the people who are in power are able to use all these things to distract us all the more.
Right. That is the conspiracy.
But this then, you know, is really, again, one of the things that made it so challenging for me in editing this movie is fundamentally knowing that we had to make a movie that embodied this idea that all these things are equally valid, that we could hold the possibilities. The film, rather than any kind of linear structure, rather than a circular structure, we had to invent a new structure, narrative structure for a film,
right,
that truly embodied the spherical nature of consciousness, where you could draw connections from any points in the film, like synapses in the brain. Here's the challenge, and I've maybe addressed this once before, and it drove me, you know, to distraction, to nuts,
you
to
went
wanting
nuts.
To you off myself. Went. To honor the possibility of all voices means you can, you know, reject no voices, including the voice that seeks to reject.
Yeesh.
Whoa, how's that for a dichotomy?
Ah,
if I'm going to embrace all voices and say, no, look, all of these things have a place at their table,
right,
at this table, including the voice that says this table would be much better
if you were
without those
yeah.
voices here, if you weren't here, if he wasn't here, if she was, you have to embrace that voice too. And this is how we do it. This is how we do it, because we've now spent all these minutes talking about Josh's criticism of the film, about this idea that all these things hold validity being truly insane. We've spent all this time talking about his criticism and what a gift that is to us, because it gives us the opportunity to then discuss what we think is really important, which is the ability to go through the world saying yes, the ability to go through the world with your arms wide open, embracing the possibilities, not for what we might want them to be, but for what they truly are.
Right.
And we would not have the opportunity to discuss this if he hadn't criticized that. So is the critic doing his job or not doing his job?
Wow. Yes, of course he's doing his
job. He's only not doing his job if we want critics to get it, quote-unquote, right.
Yeah.
And then, we've fallen right back into the bad idea that we had to free ourselves from in making the movie.
There is no right.
Yeah.
So therefore, every critic
right.
is going to be great.
Does this... No, but does this contribute? Does this contribute?
Absolutely. And you know, of course, they all will. Even if we get a criticism and go, this is complete crap...
You're absolutely right.
That will be a fantastic inclusion into the conversation.
Absolutely. And provided we embrace it that way.
Yes.
Provided we do our part.
How can we not?
Because absolutely.
The movie itself invites that very thing of doing your part.
Well, that is a perfect segue to something that was written to me from Danae. I said I wouldn't mention the name, so I'm not going to. Sorry, Ixnay. Don't go backwards. From a wonderful young lady, saw our film along with her boyfriend, her significant other, came to see the film at San Leandro at the UFO X Fest, and. But we're not listeners of this show, didn't probably know about the film in advance, but have shared both become likers of the film on Facebook.
Thank
you. In the wake of it, and have had really nice things to say. And I just dropped this young lady a line to say, you know, not only thank you for coming to that screening, but thank you for the very nice words that you're saying, because we do appreciate people spreading the word and having this conversation with other people. And anyway, she wrote something to me because... You know, one of the reasons that I want to thank and be grateful is that the people, it's very easy, is it not, to go see the movie that's being advertised everywhere? It's very easy to see the movie that everybody else is seeing, even if it's crappy.
Right. Hello.
We know this as such a sad theater town in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's really hard to go see shows when you haven't heard anything about it.
Yeah.
You don't know. And, like, you know, I went to see... Clown Town City Limits at the Steve Allen Theater one night because I'd heard really funny things about it from Ari Gross.
Right.
We went there that night. There were nine of us in the audience.
Oh.
One of the stars of it, Jim Turner, a great comic actor.
Yeah.
Lily just worked with him on a pilot for Comedy Central. And he was there, and she said, you know, we came to see the show, the last performance you had. And he said, oh, you were in the crowd with nine people. And the thing was, I got the feeling from those performers, because I do feel bad for the performers. It's got to be hard to get up when you don't have much of a house.
Yeah.
But, of course, and this was the reason I brought all this dreary stuff up, is that the people who are in that house shouldn't be punished, but they also shouldn't be punished. Those are the nights where, as a performer, you've got to find it within you to give them even more, because it is hard to be adventurous enough to go see the show that isn't being talked about by everyone, that doesn't have the big marketing budget.
Right.
And when an audience member is adventurous enough to open themselves to that, Jesus, they deserve to be rewarded.
Totally.
Right? And now, even more than that, where our time and our money is under such
siege.
Incredible stress and duress stretched to the limit that anybody who opens themselves up to something different, that adventurousness, Jesus, if there's any way that I can pay that off and reward it.
Hence you replied to the email.
And so I replied to the email. And by the way, Jim Turner put a button on that. He loved our audience. He said it was a great show because the nine people loved it so much.
See?
And we loved it so much because they were giving us so much. So it was a great experience. But anyway, I let her know some of these things, this woman with whom I exchanged messages. And she said about this, about money being tight. She said, for me, money being tight has forced me to wake up. I haven't had cable TV for almost 7 years. Because I couldn't afford it. And a year and a half ago, I was laid off of my job of 8 years due to lack of business. Best thing that ever happened to me.
Wow.
And I know it's not just me. Others are going through this too. And that's comforting. So many will find that what they thought was so important before is not so interesting anymore.
Mm.
We are living in magical times. And there is so much around us where we can gravitate towards and say, oh, these are dark times, these are troubling times, these are challenging times. And all of that is true. And indeed, they are magical times because there are so many possibilities. And the first possibility is, of course, to realize that many of the accepted conventional wisdoms about how to make it through this life don't really hold water anymore.
Right.
They aren't interesting, they aren't nourishing, and indeed, they don't even work.
Right. The models are falling apart.
The
dominoes.
The good news is that it means it's up to your own soul's hunger and desire. What will satisfy that?
Right.
And the good news is such a path is terrifying.
Yes, but so rewarding.
Because it's terrifying and because it is fraught with flaws and mistakes and difficulties and pitfalls and all these
dead
things.
Ends.
Much like our movie.
Ah. Wait a sec. Did you just trash our movie?
No, I do think that it gets back to this idea that, you know, again, the magic, these are magical times, and magic is created through your ability to embrace whatever comes forward, whatever comes forward with gratitude. And that, like you would say, is that there is no such thing, therefore, as a bad review.
True.
That it all plays its part. Because we get to embrace it with gratitude, except when we're unable to, right?
Right, but the only times we're unable to is because we have an old set of mind thinking.
Probably because we're trapped in some sort of personal, trapped in some sort of ego. The bigger our reaction, the older the material. If somebody criticized the movie based on how you looked in it, you could be expected to react to it in a bit of a personal way.
No, I look forward to that review. But my
I've written that one, by the way, having been there the whole time.
Hilarious.
And apropos of this, I mean, there are so many successes even with our own industry. We're only a couple weeks removed from the Oscars. King's Speech wins Best Picture. Neither of us had it as our best film of the year.
No. Nope.
I don't even think we had it. No, I know that neither of us had it as the best of the nominated films, even. We both liked it. But I think you thought Inception was maybe the best film of the year.
I thought
Black Swan was. Hmm. So again, it wasn't. The one thing that you got to love about it, though, is that it has been so financially profitable for its cadre of independent investors because the filmmakers turned down at a time when the credit crunch was at its worst, when films were having a hard time getting financed. Fox offered full financing for that movie, and the filmmakers told them, no, we would rather go an independent route. We would rather go raise our own financing, because guess what? Then we get to participate in it.
Yes.
The risks are greater.
The more terrifying.
The rewards are potentially greater. And they, the producers, the filmmakers have made money off of it. The investors have made money off of it.
Hello, Black Swan. That's a $16 million movie that's at $270 million now.
So, there are these victories that you can find all around us.
How uplifting has this podcast been?
Now, speaking of Fox, well, we still have more time.
I know. I'm just saying, bring it down.
What?
bring it down.
Yeah, bring a Fox.
Yeah. Oh, this ain't good.
Did you see the LA Times article about... what was the headline? I wrote the headline down because I know it probably got a lot of heart rates, especially in our audience, just the pulse rate jumped off the scale. The headline in the LA Times calendar section, X-Files reopened? Question mark?
I did not see this.
So you did not see this. It was a front page calendar section a while back.
I got the New York Times here.
It ended up being about the obvious and avowed influence of the X-Files and six recent feature film releases, because the influence in television
has been enormous
and obvious, but now in six recent feature films.
Well, what'd they say?
The one that I remembered was The Adjustment Bureau, and it was indeed something that I was thinking while watching it, watching the male and female lead together, going, wow, this is really Mulder and Scully. But anyway, there was a lot of
call outs to different movies based on the X-Files. The character development or the production quality? What were they citing more?
I think more story and the gender relationship and the questing and all these sort of things.
Yeah,
but just the influence. What a long reach it's had. And, so it again begs the question of, are they going to conclude that story? Are they going to... And it seems like there's just no time.
There's no time. They're not going to do it before 2012.
Which was the whole reason.
Was the whole reason.
Meanwhile, they green light from a pitch by Mick G. Nothing to do with McDonald's, but really, sort of he does, because...
Oh, listen to you.
He doesn't make movies so much as other similar products.
Zinger! Hello! Somebody's been schooled.
But he pitched a big-budget alien sci-fi epic that they greenlit on his pitch that will be written by the man who wrote Doom and... The Expendables.
Wow.
I didn't know either of those were written.
I thought they were all improvised on set.
But so thank God Fox has that.
So, and that's McG. And what's the movie called?
I don't know. It doesn't have a name. It has a one-line pitch.
It's a one-line pitch. Do you know what the pitch was?
No. I think I just did it. How about a big budget alien? You know, when you had one, it's called The X-Files.
Big budget alien.
Yeah.
I like big budget alien.
And it's going to tie into the 2012 end of the, calendar apocalyptic idea.
Like 2012 did.
So they already had it.
Okay.
And they, hello, your answer's on the front page of the LA Times. All right. Every couple weeks we talk about Netflix and Netflix being under assault.
Yes.
And, Warner's just started their films through Facebook distribution methodology, which
is crazy.
The biggest establishment yet of warfare on Netflix. Netflix, which is amazing because it's not like these studios are pulling their product.
No.
So they still need them, but if we can kill them off with something better, we'll do it.
That we own.
That's the thing.
Yeah. So it's about owning the means of distribution.
And meanwhile, Netflix is back in the production game doing television content, and people seem to forget that they were in the production game a few years ago and failed.
Walked away.
Yeah. Red Envelope Entertainment. They shuttered it after 2 years.
Because they didn't know how to read a script, it looked like.
But they're entering the production game. Is this what this TV show brought to people by David Fincher and Kevin Spacey?
I think so, yeah.
And but TechCrunch did an article that I thought was fascinating, suggesting what a real methodology for Netflix could be. Mm. And at the same time that they did this article, there was an announcement that I guess it's NBC is airing the finale of that short-lived TV series, The Cape.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
This superhero series thing? That was, it was reduced from 13 episodes to 10 episodes, and then they decided they're not even going to air the finale.
Right.
But, you know, for those few fans that do watch it, they kind of want a conclusion. Well, we live in cool times because NBC decides, well, why don't we just stream the final episode online?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to cost us much money, and then the people can get satisfaction.
Right.
Well, at the same time, TechCrunch was writing this article about how cult series could find new life on Netflix. That's what Netflix would be really wise to be going after.
Find the old cult thing.
I mean, tell me that a series... They used Firefly as an example. Tell me a series like The Lone Gunman.
Say.
If that had failed today to live up to the expectations of a massive corporate parent that owned the network that it was being shown on, Netflix could easily take that. I mean, on average, The Lone Gunman had 7 million viewers a week, and many of those loved them. You reduce that number to 10% of the audience, you're talking about 700,000 people who would pay for a streaming subscription of Continued Adventures on Netflix.
Think of that.
Oh, my God. That would be so smart. Well,
how do we get that meeting? Make that pitch happen. What are you doing?
I think TechCrunch already did that. And I'm not sure I'm on the side of Netflix in this. I'm just saying that they are very interesting in that unlike past methodologies and past companies that seemed unassailable, hello, Blockbuster.
Yeah.
They are trying to move and develop
to grow
and to anticipate how to use the coming changes.
Though Netflix crashes both my Firefox and my Safari when I try stream a movie on it now. What happened there?
I don't know.
It goes over and over, and I file reports, and still.
I don't have that problem because, you know, it just streams direct to my Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And when you say hate, that's such a...
Yeah, you know. I mean that lovingly.
You know, this summer, ultraviolet is being introduced.
The light spectrum, we've always had that. It's past violet on our rays, invisible light.
No, it's the new consumer entertainment distribution methodology.
Oh.
Much like CDs were meant to replace vinyl.
Yeah.
And then finally, we get to MP3 format and we realize, oh, it's this and that. You can now convert your vinyl. Because the problem with vinyl was always, if you wanted to walk around listening to it, you had to make a cassette tape.
Right.
You know, if you wanted to play it on road trips, you wanted to, right? But MP3s now, iPods, we can convert our vinyl records into those, carry it all around. Whatever format you prefer, the delivery system lets you have that. So the big companies are concerned that whatever will replace disc technology, not make disc technology irrelevant.
Right.
That people, I love that the big companies realize this, that they cannot force again audiences to rebuild their library a third time. They did it from VHS to DVD. So this ultraviolet system that is becoming consumer, it's available for sale starting this summer.
Okay.
Everything is digital. You purchase something, no matter where you purchase it, from Amazon or Netflix or whatever store you purchase it from, your film is stored in what is called the cloud.
Yes. I've heard this concept for many years now.
And you have your own library that can be as big or as small in the cloud. Now, if you already own a film, you put that DVD in your computer, let your account scan it, they will be able to prove, yes, you have an official copy, not a bootleg copy, an official copy of a retail copy of that particular film, and you automatically get a copy of it in the cloud.
Wow.
So you'll get basically the same library that you have on DVD also in the cloud.
So, but that's only on purchase, not rentals.
Right.
So yeah. I purchased the DVD, but then what do I do with the actual physical DVD? I give it back?
No, you can still have that. You can watch it on your computer. You can do whatever. But it means that if you ever don't want to be doing that anymore and you like the technology of the cloud, you'll already own it on there too.
Oh, right.
So I don't have to reset. Of the one that you already did. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's well, not sunk cost. So that's kind of an interesting wrinkle that they're doing.
Good for them. Way to think that through. Network executives. I don't know who thought that through.
Well,
but I heard about the cloud concept back in the Google days. There was visionaries talking the cloud.
Okay, so our show is up. I'm going to end it with one last question. We didn't get to any of the movies we've seen, any of the movies being developed. We talked about so much other stuff, but I'm going to end with one question to you. There was a headline that was posed that based on this pilot season, it's the end of ageism on television.
Awesome.
Do you believe that?
I never believe that. Yeah. But if they say that...
I believe, and I ask you because we've talked about this before, that the one thing that could help, much like, remember years ago when it drove us nuts that no good films or no interesting films would be released in January and February, and now look at it, January is a huge box office month.
Yeah.
We would, from the time this show started, talk about how January could be a huge box office month if you released the right product. Box office business is year-round, baby.
That's right.
Stop. It's a wrong, dead idea to think that it's just between these months.
The summer, yeah.
And indeed, now we were proven. We were dogged by cunning foresight. But we also have said this, that the problem of ageism on television was really short-sighted because we're a culture that's getting older.
Yes.
And
really, the kids aren't watching TV as much anymore.
And so, you know, I understand it's all driven by advertising revenue, but every show, the cool thing is you really just need to have a loyal following. And if the show can be made within the financial parameters that following allows, then do it.
Yeah.
Appealing to 30 million people is a thing of the past.
Yeah.
And so therefore the good news, as cable programmers have already known, you can have leads of varying ages that deal with it, because you don't have to worry about hitting all ages, especially because the attempt to hit all ages now seems to be to
ridiculous.
Talk down to all of them.
Exactly. It's an insult.
And the other thing that I would say about this is if you want to get kids back to watching TV, you know, you got to hit them young enough. And one of the things is, you know what? It was kind of fun for me growing up watching shows with my family.
Yeah, family entertainment.
The fun of it.
Yep.
And family entertainment didn't need to be boring. It meant family entertainment, again, means the inverse of what we're getting. It means speak to all ages without talking down to any of them.
Hello, Archie Bunker.
Have different levels that will speak to you as you grow older. That's one of the reasons why, again, the legacy of Star Trek is what it was.
Absolutely. Well, we have gone way over our time. So...
Well, we're packed in with almost 5% more hour.
Yes. So till next week, I'm Dean Haglund.
Be a liker of the show Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Go to MySpace. Be a friend of the show, MySpace.com/ChillPackHollywood. Follow us on Twitter, Dean's Twitter.com/DHaglund. I'm Twitter.com/PhilLerner. See you next week.
There we go.